From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On this Memorial Day edition of Fresh Air, the story of a platoon in Iraq that was part of the most hard-hit battalion since Vietnam. They suffered so many devastating losses that at one point, the men in the platoon decided they couldn't go back to patrolling the streets. They were afraid their desire for revenge would lead them to hurt civilians. We talk with Kelly Kennedy, who was embedded with this platoon and wrote the book, They Fought for Each Other. Also, The Things They Carried, a classic book about the Vietnam War, has been re-released in a 20th anniversary edition. We hear from the author, Tim O'Brien. And Jean Dubrow reads poems about being a wife whose husband is deployed overseas. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On this Memorial Day, we have the story of a platoon in Iraq that was in the hardest-hit battalion since Vietnam, and why these soldiers decided they could no longer fulfill their mission in the surge. Their reaction was described by some as a mutiny. They were tired and angry at the insurgents, insurgents who paid children to throw grenades at the soldiers. On one horrific day, they had suffered a series of devastating losses. The men in the platoon were so tired and angry, they were afraid if they returned to patrolling the streets, they'd lose control and murder civilians. My guest, Kelly Kennedy, was embedded with these men, the 2nd Platoon Charlie Company 126, in June 2007. She was with them on their worst day and on the day a first sergeant committed suicide in front of his men. The platoon was in Ahmadiyya, one of the most violent neighborhoods in Baghdad. Kennedy's new book is called They Fought for Each Other, The Triumph and Tragedy of the Hardest Hit Unit in Iraq. Kennedy covers health and medical issues for the Army Times, which is published by Gannett, not the military. She served in the Army from 1987 to 93, including tours in the Gulf War and Mogadishu. Our interview was recorded in March. Kelly Kennedy, welcome to Fresh Air. One of the more dramatic incidents you write about was when a 19-year-old Ross McGinnis threw himself on a grenade to save four friends. Would you describe what happened?
Sure. Ross McGinnis was 19 years old. He had big brown eyes and this huge grin, and he was silly, just kept the guys in giggles all the time. And about a week before December 4th, they'd been out on patrol, and someone threw a grenade into a truck, and everyone jumped out, and it turned out to be a dud, so everyone was safe. And then Ross kind of made jokes about it, like, no way, man, I'd be jumping out. I'd be the first one out of the truck. And so they spent the next week kind of practicing, you know, throwing tennis balls into the trucks and then diving out. And then on December 4th, they're out on patrol, and the grenade came right in through Ross's turret, and he was the gunner. And he sees it. He tries to catch it. He's chasing it around the turret, and he's yelling grenade, trying to get the guys out of the truck. And no one really understood what was happening, and they didn't have time to react, but Ross knew what was going on. So he chased it all the way back down into the truck, and then one of the other guys, Ian Newland, saw the grenade and watched as Ross McGinnis threw himself against it and took the brunt of the force of the grenade and died instantly, but saved four of his friends. And that was really interesting to me because you hear hero stories like that, but you don't necessarily hear how that affects the men he's with. So they're so grateful for what he did, but also always trying to figure out how they could have saved him.
And one man in particular, Ian Newland, thought that he could have done more to save McGinnis. Ian Newland thought that he should have died too. What impact did that have on him?
This is fairly common in combat stress that these guys feel guilt over over things that there's no way they could have changed. That Newland didn't have time to do anything to fix that situation. So he feels like every single day he has to live up to this gift that McGinnis gave him. And I think he's coming to terms with that now. He's working on opening a horse ranch in Colorado to try to help wounded veterans or veterans dealing with PTSD or post-traumatic stress disorder.
Now, you mentioned that, among other things, after the grenade, he had traumatic brain injury. And that's a pretty common injury now in Iraq and probably in Afghanistan, too, because of the IEDs. I think if you are in a vehicle that is hit or close to a vehicle that is hit by an IED, the aftershock of that can cause a concussion or a traumatic brain injury. Would you describe how frequently you think men in the company that you were following ended up with traumatic brain injury, whether it was diagnosed or not?
Sure. There's varying degrees of a traumatic brain injury. In the civilian world, we've always called them concussions. You know, it's, you know, football injury is a concussion. So these guys were generally dealing with mild traumatic brain injuries. But even a mild traumatic brain injury can cause short-term memory loss, really bad headaches, confusion in the anger issues. Some of the guys actually end up with epilepsy, with seizures. And these guys, every single one of them had been involved in some sort of a blast. And the blast wave actually travels through the brain all through your whole body, and they're still sort of studying how that affects you. If this blast wave is going through blood, then tissue, then bone, how does that affect it? But there were guys who were saying they were hit in as many as 15 times, and it was important for them. They felt like it was important for them to always go out with their guys, so they'd sort of try to scoot through on the testing afterward. The medics would do tests to see if they'd been injured, if there had been a traumatic brain injury. And part of the test was a memory test, you know, look at these three words and then recite them back to me. But the guys memorized all the words ahead of time so that they could keep going out on patrol. So diagnosing it was difficult anyway.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Kelly Kennedy. She's a reporter for the Army Times, and she has a new book called They Fought for Each Other, The Triumph and Tragedy of the Hardest Hit Unit in Iraq. She embedded with this unit in June of 2007. You were with the company you were embedded with on their worst day. This was in June 21st of 2007. What made that day the worst day?
Yeah, we'd spent a couple of days with them. I'd gone out with that unit in particular because I'd heard they had a really amazing group of medics, and I wanted to do a story about that. And I was also reporting on combat stress, and I knew they'd been hit pretty hard. So we went on patrols with them. Every patrol we went on, there was another roadside bomb or an IED. And, I mean, usually they'd find them and blow them up, but I think they were all scared already because they knew that there were more bombs out there. So on the morning of June 21st, we went out on patrol with them, and then they went out again. And the photographer, Rick Kozak, and I decided to stay back and do some interviews while they went out on that second patrol. And we were actually sitting out on some picnic tables talking to the guys about combat stress when we heard an explosion. And what had happened was a Bradley, a 30-ton vehicle, had rolled over a massive, deep-buried bomb. And it was so big that it flipped the Bradley over and left a hole the size of a Humvee in the road. And an interpreter, an Iraqi interpreter, and four of the guys died instantly. And then a fifth guy was caught underneath the Bradley and couldn't get away as it was burning. And back at the aid station, all the guys knew was that this Bradley had been hit. They didn't know who was in it. They didn't know how bad it was. They knew it was on fire and that the guys were trapped inside, but they weren't hearing any more information than that. We sat there for about an hour just waiting. It was the worst hour ever, waiting to hear what had happened. And then one of the guys heard over the radio that they'd all died. And then as another unit, the 630th MPs were responding to June 21st to that Bradley explosion, one of their female MPs was hit by a rocket-propelled grenade, and it decapitated her in front of four of her teammates in a Humvee. And then their chaplain was coming out to assist. And as he was driving out, they ran over yet another IED in a Humvee, and the driver's legs were pretty messed up after that, and Chaplain Choi ended up with some pretty bad bruising. And so they finally get back in, and everyone's dealing with that, and the battalion commander comes out, Colonel Eric Schacht, and as they're preparing the body bags and taking care of the guys, they notified the colonel that he needed to go back to the main base, where they told him that his son had died that day. He had a 13-year-old son who had a heart condition, and he died. So, the day just kept getting worse and worse and worse, to the point where you wonder how anyone could deal with it. It was horrifying.
Well, the men in the platoon were wondering how they could deal with it. Why don't you describe the range of emotional reactions you observed among the survivors in this platoon?
Sure. You know, it was all over the place the way they reacted. And there's a soldier named Gary Dinardi who was trying to get out of the gate. You know, he's standing at the gate trying to run out into the street to help people in the guards were actually holding him back, and he threw a water bottle and was sort of stomping around. There's another guy, Eric Osterman, who very calmly started spreading water down on the sand to try to keep the dust down, and making sure other people had water to hydrate. It was really hot that day. The medics were very calmly going about setting up the aid station, and they didn't know how many people they'd be bringing in. A lot of guys just sitting down with their heads in their hands and distraught and waiting. And there was one soldier who was actually really upset that there were, that the media were there on that day.
The media, meaning you and your photographer.
Exactly. They had dealt with so many reporters in the past and generally did pretty well with it. But that day was so personal to them, and they were so upset about coverage in general that, you know, their friends would die and it would come up as a number on the news and no one would know who those guys really were. And they just wanted people to know who their friends were, who they'd lost. And I think they were afraid that we were going to go back and do this sensationalistic story and use it in a political way. That was their other complaint, was that their stories were often used to show that the surge wasn't working, and they didn't want it to be political. So one of the soldiers, we were asked to go inside after a while. They're like, the soldiers are, the soldiers need to calm down, so can you go inside for a minute? And Rick and I had both been sort of standing way back. I mean, we understood what had happened, and we understood that to do the reporting and the photography that day, we didn't need to be on top of them, didn't need to make that day any worse. And I found out later on, we went to Germany when they came home, and one of the guys, we'd been drinking beer and hanging out all night, and he started crying and told me that he locked and loaded on me that day, that he was so angry that he'd considered shooting me, and the guys pulled him back. And he's someone I hear from all the time now. He's a good kid. But the moment was so traumatizing for him. He needed to take his anger out somewhere. And I was sort of the target of that. So,
my guest is Kelly Kennedy. Her new book is called They Fought for Each Other, The Triumph and Tragedy of the Hardest Hit Unit in Iraq. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Kelly Kennedy. Her new book, They Fought for Each Other, is about a platoon that was in the hardest-hit battalion since Vietnam. She was embedded with this platoon in June 2007, and she was with them on their worst day, a day she just described. Now, one of the men shot himself not long after this worst day.
Right.
Tell us his story.
His name was First Sergeant Jeff McKinney, and he was known for singing on patrol Sesame Street songs, and pretty squared away. The other first sergeants in the unit would go to him if they needed help with something, they needed to learn something. He had a new wife and a new baby, and he was talking about retirement and was all excited about that. But he was also really stressing out over not being able to take care of his men as well as he wanted to. He felt like they weren't getting the food and the water they needed. So he'd do things like not drink or not eat, and he wouldn't sleep because he felt like he needed to be taking care of his guys constantly. And I think the combination of those things, along with he was with First Sergeant Kenny Hendricks on June 21st when they recovered the body, so he'd seen some really bad things too. And he wasn't sleeping. He was acting strangely. His guys were noticing it. And one day they went out on patrol, and he stepped out of the Humvee, and he put his M4 under his chin and pulled the trigger in front of his men. And one of the guys who saw it in the medical records actually confirmed this, said that at the last minute he sort of twitched his head to the side as if he realized what he was doing and didn't want to. It seems to have been a instant, not thought out thing. It wasn't like he was planning it, and he hadn't been suicidal in the past. It just That's how his stress sort of erupted for him that day. And the interesting thing about it was the other first sergeants, after it happened, wondered if they were close to the same. They didn't look at it as, you know, he's weak, or we don't understand why he did this. They saw it as, this is a bad place, and we're going through a lot, and I need to take better care of myself and my men.
Well, shortly after the suicide and after the worst day for this platoon, they thought that they couldn't go out anymore, that they just kind of hit a wall.
Right.
And although you are no longer embedded with the platoon, you write about this. So I'm sure they must have told you in detail what happened, yes?
Yes.
Yeah, so you describe that the whole platoon marched as a group to the mental health clinic. What did they have to say?
Well, soon after McKinney's suicide, they'd been told to go out on patrol, and they said, that road's black. There's bombs on that road. We know that we're not supposed to go on that road. And because of the weather, they couldn't get back out to Apache during a sandstorm or something. That mission for them got canceled, and they sent out another company instead. And those guys went out in their 30-ton Bradley and hit another deep-buried IED, and June 21st happened all over again. And these guys were in a different company, but they were friends still. They were guys they knew, and it felt like for the guys, like their leadership had let them down, had let them die. So yeah, they went to mental health, and they said, if we go out on patrol in Adamia, we're going to kill everyone in our paths. We're so angry that we cannot function with any kind of ethical code at this point. And the therapist, the mental health counselor, said, you know, at some point you need to stand down. If you guys think that you're going to make bad decisions and do things that are going to ruin your lives and others, then you need to stand down.
Okay, so you have this whole platoon that decides they can't go out again. They're even afraid that they're going to end up killing civilians and going to jail for it because they're that angry. They truly feel like they cannot contain their anger anymore. So what did their leadership have to say? I mean, the mental health experts agreed these men shouldn't go out. What did the leadership have to say?
Well, the leadership was, there was definitely a lack of communication. The company commander didn't know about the trip to the mental health clinic, and he didn't know about the medications they were on.
Was he new?
He was fairly new. Yeah. He'd come in the spring, and this was in the summer. But their platoon sergeant apparently hadn't relayed the message, and the platoon sergeant, who was also a former drill instructor, felt like they should be obeying the order. You know, even though he'd said in the past that it was time for 2nd Platoon to stand back, he wanted them to go out that day. There was some talk about how it wasn't fair for 2nd Platoon to stand back because that just meant someone else had to go out in their place. But then the company commander actually came out later and said, I was disappointed that they didn't follow my order. That's their job. That's the military mission. But I respect them for what they did. I respect them for understanding where they were at in that moment and for not going out that day.
So in the long run, they weren't seen as either selfish or cowardly, but as kind of accurately representing their state of mind and thinking that their state of mind was an inappropriate state of mind to go out on a military mission.
Right. Ultimately, they were eventually seen as courageous for that decision.
Was it considered a mutiny?
You know, that's a word that some people in the battalion used. So I don't think it was considered a full-on mutiny once people understood the background to it. But they definitely refused to follow an order, and it was known within the battalion as the 2nd Platoon mutiny.
So just to make sure I understand correctly, so when the platoon decided they couldn't go out and the mental health expert said you shouldn't be going out, but then the command said, no, you need to go out, the platoon still did not go out.
Right.
And so what was the immediate punishment and what was the end of the story?
They were administratively flagged, which meant that they couldn't get awards or promotions or go on leave or anything like that. And that lasted for about 2 months. And then the company commander said, I think that's enough. They pulled the sergeants out of the platoon and gave them new leadership, which the guy saw as punishment, but the first sergeant and the company commander saw as a way to sort of get them back in a fighting mode again. And they still had to cover their battle space, even with this platoon had sort of broken in the middle of the mission. So
how much more time did they have after this mutiny?
About 3 months after the mutiny, they went home.
And did they all survive? Did everybody in this platoon who refused to follow orders survive the remaining 3 months?
They did. Throughout their tour, that platoon had lost 9 men. A platoon's about 40 guys. But from that moment on, everyone was okay. There was one more injury after that. It was a medic who was out on patrol and was shot, Tyler Holliday. But he lived. He was okay.
Kelly Kennedy will be back in the second half of the show. Her new book is called They Fought for Each Other, The Triumph and Tragedy of the Hardest Hit Unit in Iraq. She covers health and medical issues for the Army Times. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Barnes & Noble, presenting the Nook e-reader, which offers wireless access to the Barnes & Noble e-bookstore, in stores and at nook.com. From the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and from Angie's List, providing consumer reviews on local professionals from physicians and veterinarians to plumbers and roofers. Details at angieslist.com. This is NPR.
The Things They Carried, the now classic book about the Vietnam War, has been republished in a 20th anniversary edition. Coming up, an excerpt of our 1990 interview with author Tim O'Brien. Also, what it's like to see a spouse off to war and wait for their return. Jean Dubrow reads from Stateside, her new collection of poems. And we continue our interview with Kelly Kennedy. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Kelly Kennedy, who covers health and medical issues, including PTSD, for the Army Times. She's the author of the new book, They Fought for Each Other, The Triumph and Tragedy of the Hardest Hit Unit in Iraq. She was embedded with a platoon in this unit, 2nd Platoon Charlie Company 126, in June 2007, and was with them on their worst day, a day she described earlier in the interview. What impact did that day have on you? Do you feel like you ended up with post-traumatic stress disorder?
Well, post-traumatic stress disorder is, there's a full range of symptoms you have, but people call some of those symptoms that people generalize sort of as PTSD. When I got home, I was blowing through stop signs. I just didn't see them. I would get up in the morning to read the paper, and it would take me 3 hours. I was just very distracted. And I was sad for about a year. I think I was in a mild depression. So I'd say sort of some anxiety issues for me. Nothing like what the guys are dealing with, the nightmares and the flashbacks and that sort of thing. And I mean, I didn't have any of the guilt kind of stuff to deal with.
Well, what about the men after returning? You kept up with them. Did most of them suffer from nightmares and flashbacks and anxieties of various sorts as a result of their experiences in Iraq?
I wouldn't say most of them. I'd say a lot of them. It sounds like all of the medics are dealing with some things. A lot of the guys had nightmares. I wouldn't say all of them have full-blown post-traumatic stress, but I'm definitely hearing about guys who are leaving the military now with disability benefits because they're not able to function as well anymore. I think the rate in general is something like 20% for combat stress or post-traumatic stress disorder symptoms.
One of the people you thank in your acknowledgments is one of the medics from the platoon that you were embedded with, Tyler Halliday. You thank him for making you feel like part of the group, not just a reporter looking for a scoop. You write a lot about the stresses of being a medic in Iraq, especially, you know, with that platoon anyways. And you say that the medics in that platoon were taking on the men's psychological as well as physical problems, treating them for psychological issues. And they were just absorbing all of these problems and not having anybody to go to themselves. Now, he was very seriously injured. What happened to this medic?
Tyler was out on patrol, and they were looking at abandoned vehicles and trying to get rid of them. They were calling in to have someone come pick them up. And as he was coming back from one of the vehicles, he got hit by a sniper in the stomach. And I mean, the stomach wound is something that the guys fear more than just about anything because it's hard to address immediately as a medic. And for Tyler, it was terrifying because he was the medic. There wasn't another medic with him. So he'd done some training with his guys to try to help them if they were in a situation like that or in case of a large amount of casualties where he couldn't do everything himself. But all the medics talk about how that first injury is the most difficult one to treat. So he's surrounded by guys who haven't necessarily done it before and giving them instructions. You need to do this. You need to use a wet bandage, not a dry bandage. And he could feel his stomach filling with fluids. And as he's telling these guys what to do, he's certain he's going to die. And he's telling them to tell the other medics that he loves them. And he's just sure he's done. And it turned out that if he'd had an appendix, he would have been, it would have killed him. But because his appendix had been removed, the bullet didn't actually hit anything that he needed immediately, and they were able to save him.
Tell us a little bit about some of the stresses that the medics in the platoon you were embedded with had to deal with. Why was it so stressful for them? And how were their stresses different than the stresses of the other men in the platoon?
Yeah, the infantry tends to be a little macho, so one of the things they know can help for combat stress is to talk about it. But if you're a tough guy, it's really hard to talk to your buddy about it. So the medics, who were not in their chain of command, were sort of a neutral, sort of a safe place to go talk. And they knew that if they told the medics, they weren't going to go talking about it to anybody else. So someone would be having nightmares, and Doc Holliday would listen to the stories about the nightmares and try to get the person back on track. Or someone would have a really bad day, you know, see another dead body on the street for a while. They were picking up 10 bodies a day and need someone to sort of talk it out with what he'd seen. And Doc Holliday would listen. And then when they did get casualties, he was not only treating the guys, but if they died, he was the one who was identifying the bodies and loading them in the body bags. So it wasn't just that he was dealing with injured men, he was dealing with his injured men. He was dealing with these guys who told them, you know, their fears and their hopes and their friends. They're the guys that they drank beer with back home. And I think it's a whole different thing for a medic in the military as opposed to, you know, a regular doctor.
Well, Kelly Kennedy, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Kelly Kennedy is the author of They Fought for Each Other, The Triumph and Tragedy of the Hardest Hit Unit in Iraq. She covers health and medical issues for the Army Times. You can read a chapter of her book on our website, freshair.npr.org. One of the classic works of fiction about the Vietnam War, The Things They Carried, was recently republished in a 20th anniversary edition. Coming up, we hear from the author, Tim O'Brien. This is Fresh Air. On this Memorial Day, we're going to hear from the author of a classic book of stories about the Vietnam War, The Things They Carried. It was republished in a 20th anniversary edition in March. The author, Tim O'Brien, served in Vietnam as an infantryman in 1968. I spoke with him in 1990 when the book was first published. This collection of stories is tied together by a fictional narrator whose name is also Tim O'Brien. In this passage, the narrator is reading a 17-page disjointed letter in which his former combat buddy writes about the problem of finding a meaningful life after fighting in the war.
I felt it coming, and near the end of the letter it came. He explained that he had read my first book, If I Die in a Combat Zone, which he liked except for the bleeding heart political parts. For half a page, he talked about how much the book had meant to him. How it brought back all kinds of memories, the villes and paddies and rivers, and how he recognized most of the characters, including himself, even though almost all the names were changed. Then Bowker came straight out with it. What you should do, Tim, is write a story about a guy who feels like he got zapped over in that A guy who can't get his act together and just drives around town all day and can't think of any damn place to go and doesn't know how to get there anyway. The guy wants to talk about it, but he can't. If you want, you can use the stuff in this letter, but not my real name, okay? I'd write it myself, except I can't find any words, if you know what I mean, and I can't figure out what exactly to say. Something about the field that night, the way Kiowa just disappeared into the crud. You were there. You can tell it.
Has anything like that actually ever happened to you, getting a letter from a friend or having a friend say to you, you've got to tell my story, I can't do it, but you've got to tell it?
Oh, it's happened hundreds and hundreds of times. I've never taken them up on the offer, and even in this case I didn't. The letter is made up.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel that people almost define themselves by maybe a half dozen or a dozen stories that describe the pivotal incidents in their life?
I do. In my own life, you know, I would say there are a handful, maybe a dozen incidents that are like touchstones that recurred over and over in my fiction. There's one incident in the book about the shooting of a baby water buffalo in Vietnam, and the image of a defenseless water buffalo being shot over and over and over again is one that has appeared in, I think, everything I've written, or close to everything I've written. I'm not sure, you know, what the image is there for in terms of symbol or metaphor. Probably nothing. It just has the feel of meat, which was the feel of war. Flesh and blood, and a poor baby buffalo being shot over and over and over again. That's a senseless, you know, that's war.
Well, in the novel, the person who's shooting the water buffalo is doing it after he's seen a friend of his die. You know,
yes.
one of his buddies die, and this is interpreted as a kind of not exactly revenge, but venting, some kind of venting of the frustration. Did you witness something like this? Is that why the image keeps recurring in your fiction?
Yeah, I did. I witnessed. We were walking along a paddy dike one day after a horrible, a few hours in a village adjacent to the village of My Lai, where the massacre happened. We lost several fellows who'd hit landmines. And the platoon was lined up in a long, long row, across the paddy dike, and 100 yards away stood a water buffalo. And with no signal, the men began firing. And the buffalo stood there, and you could see gobs of flesh, you know, jumping off the beast. And it stuck.
Were you one of the men who fired?
No. I watched, dumbly. I understood it. You can't justify something like that, but there was no enemy to take it out on. Men were feeling sorrow and rage simultaneously, and the buffalo was there to bear the brunt.
How vivid are your memories from the war? I mean, how much do you think you remember of what, the year that you were there?
Oh, a few scattered images. The way if you were to pick up a photographic album and page through it, you'd maybe 7 or 8 pictures would be, there. That would be really vivid. Another 24 or so you'd vaguely recollect. And the rest of the album is empty. A lot of black pages. Which you'd expect, I think, that our memories leave us. But beyond that, a lot of the war was not memorable. Plodding along from village to village, hot days, mosquitoes. It was a kind of monotony to it, but a strange monotony, with boredom with a twist.
What was the twist?
The twist was a kind of like a leaky faucet in your stomach, and instead of water, there was this acid feeling dropping out where you can feel it just eating away inside you. You're bored, frightened simultaneously. Try it sometime. It's tough.
Let me ask you about a couple of the images in the book and see where they come from in actuality or your imagination. I mean, what they signify to you. One of the men in the company, Henry Dobbins, is always wrapping his girlfriend's pantyhose around his head. It's his protective magic, his good luck charm.
Mm-hmm.
Did a lot of the men have something like that? Did you have anything like that yourself?
No, I didn't carry pantyhose, but there were talismans that men carried and wore, and the kind of talismans that touch on peace. That the pantyhose business is wrapped around a fellow's neck as a kind of comforter, is a reminder of all that he doesn't have, his girlfriend, and the peace that girl represents for him, and some men carried letters from home. Some men carried coins their father made and sent them. A lot of us carried photographs. Some carried lockets of hair.
What were the things that you carried with you to remind you of who you were and what it was that you loved?
I carried odd things. I carried you won't believe this, I carried a book of German grammar. I wanted to learn German while I was in Vietnam.
It seems like such a remote thing.
What an odd thing to be saying, you're Spanish, sprechen Sie Deutsch, and trying to get the accents right and learn the grammatical structures of German after marching all day long through really horrible things. It was a way of, it was a lot of us, pushing the war aside, if even for a few moments.
Well, I guess it was also a way of, affirming that you had a life of the mind, that there was more besides, your body in the war.
Yeah, I think that was a great, great part of it, and a way of just touching on civility and civilization, which for me books represented then and continue to represent. I mean, that's what they are.
What else did you carry?
I carried so much. I carried cans of orange juice that my father had sent me from Minnesota. These were just precious to me. He sent me 12 cans, and they were heavy. And it wasn't the orange juice I craved. It was the fact that these cans of orange juice had come from my dad from so far away. And I gave myself 1 month for each can. 1 can a month.
So you measured your whole tour of duty by those cans?
By those cans of orange juice.
Did you ever try to travel light?
Yeah, I mean, eventually you have to. I think you discard things. You discard odd things as a soldier. You discard things like hand grenades and belts of ammunition, the things you think you'd keep. Claymore mines. We were so burdened by stuff that we were like giants lumbering through that countryside, hauling along with us the whole, all those resources of the American war chest.
Your first book, If I Die in a Combat Zone, was really one of the early war memoirs. When did it first come out? Was it 1973?
Yes.
And then Going After Cacciato came out a few years later. It was still one of the early Vietnam novels. Was it different for you writing about the war before Vietnam had so penetrated fiction, movies, and television?
I can't say that the output of recent books and movies and so on about the war has helped me or hindered me. I haven't seen many of the movies, and I haven't read many of the books.
I'm surprised to hear that. I thought you'd be curious either to see like what other people were doing with it, or to see if how it compared to your own experiences or your own telling of the experiences.
For me at least, I'm not much interested in war stories. Most of them tend to be melodramatic and predictable and bad stories. And I think a lot of readers feel the same. We've been brought up in too many John Wayne movies and too much bad writing. This isn't true just for Vietnam, of course. It's true if you look at love stories, look at all those Harlequin romances out there. But nonetheless, there's something about the war story that makes me want to turn my head and move away gently. For me, the war is, that isn't important to me now. What's important to me is language about the war and about the human heart. I was never a very good soldier. I hated that war. And it's now in the distant past. What's in the present for me are the stories that have really, in a way, nothing to do with the war. They're set in the war, but they're stories for me of friendships and ghosts and girlfriends and that kind of thing.
Another image I want to ask you about, and I wasn't sure whether this was literary or actual.
<All right. laughs>
there's a sequence, and it's a pretty pivotal sequence where a couple of the characters in your novel are in a field of sewage, and the smell just won't go away. I mean, long after they've left, the smell just won't go away. The literary image there is clear. I was wondering if that was an actual experience too, if there were fields of sewage like this that you got caught in.
Yeah, I mean, it was meant to be a description of actual things and not as metaphor, not as symbol. Just stuff,
I'm really
stuff.
Glad to hear that, by the way.
It was shocking to read in in some column or review that this is taken as a metaphor for something. It didn't occur to me as soon as it was written. I thought, oh my God, I can see it. But it was intended just as stuff. A field full of sewage that we camped in one night, and we were attacked and mortared, and a man went under.
Man went under the sewage.
Yeah, no metaphor, just under.
I'd like to try to explain why it is that I'm almost relieved that it really happened. Do you know what I mean? As something that really happened, it seems quite horrible. As something that would have been metaphor, it would seem like too much?
Yeah, it would have. In a way, it's one of those things where, if I would have, I suppose, thought a little more clearly about it all, I might have avoided it. But, what would I do? How would I change things? I probably wouldn't in the long run. I think if Melville, in writing Moby Dick, thought that whale would be finally just a metaphor, he might have changed it to a tuna fish. Not quite so godlike.
How long did it take before you could wash the sewage off and get out of there?
I never have. It's that smell is still in my dreams. It's the one thing that's really stuck with me. I don't dream Vietnam, but the smell. I don't know if you've ever had an operation that had ether.
Yes,
I did
yeah.
as a kid.
My tonsils. Getting my tonsils out.
That now and then, every 3 years or 8 years, the smell of ether returns to me. It's not set in the hospital. That's a folding feeling in the brain, just a folding over the brain with a smell inside the folds. And that's what returns to me now and then, the smell of that field of sewage folding through my dreams.
What do you think it is that it's the smell that stays with you more than anything else?
That was a pretty terrible smell.
Yeah.
And that's part of it. And part of it is, you know, I'm sure it was linked somehow to the awful thing that happened in the field that night.
Tim O'Brien recorded in 1990 after the publication of his book, The Things They Carried. A 20th anniversary edition was published in March. You can read a chapter on our website, freshair.npr.org. Tim O'Brien now teaches creative writing at Texas State University. Coming up, Jeanne Dubrow reads from her collection of poems Stateside about being a military wife whose husband is deployed overseas. This is Fresh Air. For many soldiers, sailors, and Marines deployed overseas, a family or a loved one waits at home for their return. Poet Jeanne Dubrow is one of those people waiting. Her husband, a career naval officer, is halfway through a 9-month tour of duty on a destroyer in the Western Indian Ocean, which is conducting anti-terrorism and anti-pirate operations. Dubrow's new collection of poems, Stateside, is written from the point of view of a military wife. The book has a foreword by Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Ted Kooser. We asked Dubrow to introduce and read three of her poems.
A number of the poems in Stateside take their titles from military terminology. The phrase secure for sea refers to the process of making sure that all unstable objects on a ship are safely tied down before deployment. But secure for sea is also what a family does before a sailor is deployed in preparation for the long absence. This poem is called Secure for Sea, Maritime Terminology. It means the movable stays tied, lockers hold shut, the waves don't slide a metal box across the decks, or scatter screws like jacks. The sea, like a rebellious child that wrecks all tools which aren't fastened tightly or fixed. At home, we say secure when what we mean is letting go of him. And even if we're sure he's coming back, it's hard to know, the farther out a vessel drifts, will contents stay in place or shift? My next poem talks about a time after my husband and I first married, when I found myself seeing danger where I hadn't seen it before. Even channel surfing became risky. I could no longer watch the History Channel or the nightly news, and the silliest of war movies made me cry. Against war movies. I see my husband shooting in platoon, and there he is again in MASH. How weird to hear him talk like Hawkeye Pierce. And soon, I spot him everywhere, his body smeared with mud, his face bloodied. He's now the star of every ship blockade and battle scene, the Fighting 69th, A Bridge Too Far, Three Kings, Das Boot, and Stalag 17. In Stalingrad, he's killed, and then he's killed in Midway, and a few good men. He's burned or gassed, he's shot between the eyes, or shoots himself when he comes home again. Each movie is a training exercise, a scenario for how my husband dies. When I think about my husband on deployment, I imagine him pared down to the essentials, his uniforms, perhaps a couple of military manuals, and a few personal possessions, nothing else. Everything from the civilian world is left behind. This next poem is called Non-Essential Equipment. The dog and I are first among those things that will not be deployed with him. Forget civilian clothes as well. He shouldn't bring too many photographs, which might get wet, the faces blurred. He only needs a set of uniforms. Even his wedding ring gives pause. What if it fell? he'd be upset to dent or scratch away the gold engraving. The sea bag must be light enough to sling across his shoulder, weigh almost nothing, each canvas pocket emptied of regret. The trick is packing less. No wife, no pet, no perfumed letters dabbed with I love yous, or anything he can't afford to lose.
Jeanne Dubrow, reading three poems from her new collection, Stateside. She teaches creative writing at Washington College in Chestertown, Maryland. You can read the full text of the three poems we heard on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Today's show was produced by Roberta Shirok. Our engineers are Audrey Bentham and Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Melody Kramer is our associate producer for online media. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. From the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day, at wallacefoundation.org. And from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, working to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air.
All right. We're giving our neighbor a joyride. Anyone want to go on a joyride with us? How about you?
We'll listen back to interviews with the late actor Dennis Hopper about his films, his childhood, his love of contemporary art, and what he learned about acting from his friend, James Dean. Join us.